Are we addicted to energy, or are we addicted to the power the energy creates? We'll talk about that and much more on this episode of The Crude Truth.
In 1901, at Spindletop Hill near Beaumont, the future of Texas changed dramatically as, like a fountain of fortune, thousands of barrels of oil burst from the earth towards the sky. Soon, Detroit would be cranking out Model Ts by the millions, and America was on the move, thanks to the black gold being produced in Texas. Now, more than a century later, the vehicles are different, but nothing else has truly changed. Sure, there may be many other alternative energy sources like wind and solar and electric, but let's be honest, America depends on oil and entrepreneurs, and if the USA is truly going to be independent, it has to know the crude truth.
This episode of The Crude Truth is brought to you by Oil and Gas Workers Association, Sandstone Group, Air Compressor Solutions, Basin Fluids, and The Fuel Pros.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. How are you all doing? Thank you again for tuning in for another episode of The Crude Truth. Please be sure to like our channel, subscribe to my Substack, subscribe to any notifications that I may have. Thank you very much. And please be sure to leave any comments or questions. I'd love to answer any questions that you may have on any of the episodes that we do here on The Crude Truth. Today, I'm just too excited. My guest today, and I know I say that every time, is a profound thought leader in the energy sector, not just oil and gas. He touches on everything from solar to nuclear and everything in between. He is a podcast host himself. He is actually a movie producer with things that he's produced like Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. He has authored books like Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Imran, and also my favorite, Power Hungry, The Myth of Green Energy and the Fuels of the Future, and also the host of the Power Hungry podcast. Our guest today is Robert Rice. Robert, how are you?
Hi, thanks for having me, Ray. Good to see you.
Oh, man, great to see you, and welcome simulcast to the Crude Truth Studios here. I think you're in your bunker down in an undisclosed location today, so I cannot complain. I know we had a great chance to visit during the introduction. Again, I'm a huge fan. Had a great opportunity to read your book, Power Hungry, and also just the fact that all the great things that you've been up to for the last over 15 years talking about energy and just all the common sense that we really need in this this world today more than ever.
Well, that's very kind. Thanks. I'm passionate about the energy and power networks. This is my purpose in my life, and I'm working hard, but having more fun than ever. So, but I also, motivated by the fact that so much of the public and so many of our policymakers are innumerate and scientifically illiterate, and that is something I try to address. We need to be thinking about in very cold and sober terms, rather, I'll say, in sober terms about what we're doing with our energy and power networks and how I firmly believe they're being fragilized, they're being undermined by bad policy and bad incentives.
Well, one thing I want people to know is that you're not a pro-oil, pro-gas, like you are just a common sense guy when it comes to energy. And I just want all our listeners to know that out there, that it's like you're not looking at one or the other. It's like, hey, guys, this is what we need to do if we if we go more wind and solar, here's what it's going to take. If we go more mining, you're going to break it down on how much more land we're going to use, so your views and the way you look at things are from a very non-biased way, is what I definitely want our listeners to know about you.
Well, that's kind. I try and approach these issues from the math and the physics, and they don't lie. The numbers are the numbers. They're not my numbers. They are the numbers. And what I try to do, one of the best pieces of advice I've heard in my career, Ray, was a guy named Edward Tufte. He said, when you give people a number, give them something to compare it to. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting, it's critical to have people, if you're going to explain things. I think about my late mother when I'm writing. Will she understand this the first time? And so I rely on physics, I rely on basic math, and also try to bring that then as I'm writing and explaining things and making graphics, how can I explain this in the way that is the simplest but also the most effective? So, and you know, to your, you know, you made a point, I'm a reporter. I don't work for industry. I never have worked in industry. I've been a journalist my whole career, and I bring my skill, the skills that I've gained, I think, over the last 30 years of doing this as a reporter to shine light on these issues, because the energy, our energy and power networks are the most important networks in our society.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the energy networks, because I want to kind of softly just dive into your great book, and I'll show it here, Power Hungry, The Myth of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. If anybody has never read this book, it is a great read, and I promise it will not take you as long as you think it will to read this book. Why? Because you're just enjoying it. I know I reread it after I got a chance to invite Robert to come on the show, and I had a good cup a glass of whiskey and a cigar, and I knocked it out in about 2 weeks, you know, just smoking one cigar about every other day. And so it's a great read, so I recommend it to anybody. But here you are talking about the infrastructure, and in your book you talk about how just here in the United States we have built, and I think we've got new numbers, but in the book you write, and granted the book was written in 2008, a $14 trillion economy. We now have above a $20 trillion economy that is based off of cheap, reliable fuel, which what provides us the power and the energy, which then provides us the power we need to be the powerhouse that we are here in the United States. And so I just think that's something that's awesome.
Well, thank you. And that book now is 13 years old. It came out in 2010. And I'm proud of it. I don't think it has aged much at all. I think, you know, I'd stand behind everything that's in that book. I talk a lot in that book about coal, and coal continues to be a big driver and a key fuel for the electricity systems around the world. In fact, coal demand, the IEA numbers just came out a few weeks ago. Coal demand rose again last year in 2022, not as much as it has in previous years, but it rose again. So did oil demand. In fact, oil demand grew last year faster than coal demand. So. What you said earlier, though, I think is key, and that is that we live in a hydrocarbon economy, and that was true 13 years ago. It's true today, and it's going to be true in a decade. It's going to be true in 2 decades. One of the things that I'm really focused on lately is this idea of the energy transition. We hear about this over and over, particularly under the Biden administration. Yeah. I'm not a partisan. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm disgusted. But this administration, more than any other, has pushed this narrative that we're going to simply switch away from hydrocarbons, and we're going to do it quickly, and it's going to be easy. No, it's not. It's not going to be quick. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take decades, if it happens at all.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, this administration is definitely the most anti-oil that I've ever seen, and coal, and due to their policies, like you mentioned, coal went up this past year, and so did oil, due to the fact that we had these natural disasters in America, where we couldn't get the solar to come in, we couldn't get the wind to come in. I know there in Austin, last month and a half ago, they had a big major power outage, and that was actually due to some of the in Austin, Texas, that is, that the due to policies that they have caused them to be the only ones in the state of Texas almost to not have any power for a day or two.
Well, that's a kind of a different issue in terms of, you know, vegetation management, and that they weren't trimming trees enough, and so we had an ice storm here that, you know, it was freezing rain for 48 hours or so. So it was, I mean, we lost tons of trees in my neighborhood. But I think the key issues here, Ray, are that we have to be very sober about our energy and power networks. And, you know, policymakers, and, you know, I'm not here to bash the Biden administration, but I will agree they have promoted a lot of agendas, a lot of issues that, you know, have not been favorable, I think that's an understatement, to the domestic oil and gas sector. But I also think it's true that the U.S. oil and gas sector has not been spending as much, simply because they have been constrained by shareholders. That, you know, during the shale revolution, $300 billion in shareholder capital was destroyed. Now, that was to the benefit of the U.S. economy. We got a lot cheap, you know, oil and gas were far cheaper for consumers. But I want to make it clear that it's not just the Biden administration that's constraining the oil and gas sector today. There are constraints on capital. And so I've interviewed Scott Sheffield. I've talked to a lot of people in the oil and gas sector. What has happened is that the oil and gas sector has been forced to be more to return more capital to investors. And that's what investors want. And so this is a new paradigm, and it's one that I don't think is going to change. You know, drillers are upstream. The upstream is going to be more cautious. They're going to return more capital to investors because that's what investors are demanding, and rightly so.
No, I mean, you know, that is something that is more than important to get your money back or get that monthly mailbox check. For us at Pecos Country Operating, you know, we're a small operator, so we the production that we do, it fuels us to do more, you know, to do more. And if we do have every now and then, we'll bring on some small investors. And you know what? I know that getting them back their money or really getting them a check every month is our pride and joy, because like, hey man, this is what you invested in. Here you go. This is your, you know, your dividend, so to speak. And I remember one guy was like surprised, like, oh wow, I get a check. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, I thought this was going to be nothing but a tax write off. And I said, no sir. I said, that's not the way we do business. You invest in us. You're believing in what we're doing. And so that is a paradigm that you mentioned that, you know, I think investors are a little hesitant with right now. It's like, is this really, really going to happen? Like, are we actually seeing these investments pay off now and we're getting these checks? I mean, you look at what the Oxys of the world and the Exxons of the world are doing. They're paying these large dividends now. And then I think even Oxys are even trying to now buy back more stock from stockholders or something there. I'm not a financial guy, so I don't want to dive into that. And then you talk about the paradigm of how, you know, there's so many different ways the word, I guess I want to say, there's so many different ways to use the word power. Here a minute ago, we were talking about the power supply in Austin was bad. And then also we talk about how, you know, energy provides power for all these great things. But the other thing that your book talks about with the word power is being, again, a national powerhouse. And that how we really, your book talks about how electricity helps the energy commodity. And it separates developed countries from the undeveloped countries from countries like the United States. So the word power really means a lot of different things when it comes to the energy sector.
Well, yes. And that's one of the things that I will underscore. Well, one quick point I just looked up. So Pioneer Natural Resources, of course, is the biggest oil producer in Texas. Yeah. Just to give you an idea, I'm just looking at the dividend yield is almost 13%. The price to earnings ratio is less than 7. So, you know, it's indicative of how investors are not, you know, they're shying away from these stocks, right? Because they're not, you know, even though they're on a numerical basis, you just look at those numbers, you say, well, that's an attractive investment.
Yeah.
But yes, let me just talk about energy and power. And power, and I'm going to make this point because people in the energy business, and I've talked to a lot of groups in the energy business, yes, they don't know the difference between energy and power, and they confuse them all the time. Energy is the ability to do work. Power is the rate at which work gets done. And that's a key distinction. Do not confuse the two. And if you don't know the distinctions, you need to read my book, Power Hungry. You need to educate yourself. But the, you know, one of the reasons why I think that the policymakers were predominantly lawyers, let's be clear, not engineers. But even among engineers, they confuse the two terms. Energy is the ability to do work. Power is the rate at which work gets done. We don't care what energy is. We care what energy allows us to do. And we don't care what that form of energy is. I often say, you know, I have a truck. I'll put, you know, sawdust or yogurt or Beanie Babies in the tank if I thought it would give me the motive power that I want. What we care about is power. We don't give a damn about what energy is. We want what energy provides, and energy provides us with power. And the higher the rate of flow, and that's the difference. Energy is a sum, power is a rate, and rates are more telling than sums. Energy is worthless unless we can make it flow, and the more we make it flow, the more power we have. So I'm being a little didactic here, but I think it's key for people in the industry to know to know that difference, and to be able to really internalize it and understand what that means, because Energy and they're often confused, even by people in the energy business. And so you need to understand these terms and that they are not the same thing.
No, no, they're not. And I'm glad that you said that, not me, because that was something I had written down in my notes, that energy is the ability to do work. Power is the rate at which work gets done. And again, I want if you have
and the more power we have, the more work we can do. And that's the key thing that we don't, you know, like we want to, you know, I don't care what kind of computer chip is in my computer. I only care that it has the power to do, you know, make my spreadsheet work or to, you know, edit my film project or whatever it is. So that ability to do work is what we're after, right? Yeah. It's not the we love energy itself. What we love is power, and that's what we're after. And of course, power has a lot of other connotations in politics and, you know, and you know, gender relations. I mean, a whole lot of things, right? You know, sexual power and, you know, political power. You know, all of these things. We talk about that in terms of dominance, but it is a fundamental. That's the fundamental driver. And the more power we have, the more power we want. That's one of the other points I make. You know, horsepower is like sex. The more we get, the more we want. Right? Yeah. So we can't. We have an insatiable desire for power of all kinds: lighting, amplification, computing, etc.
No, it is. And I just, again, I cannot recommend more. Get out, get his book. It's on Amazon. It's anywhere books are sold. Power Hungry. Please check it out. But Robert, I want to transition over to your Substack, if that's okay.
Sure.
RobertBryce.substack. That Substack has such a following. It blows me away. What you do and what you talk about. You know, here we just talked about a book that you wrote. To everybody out there, to all my listeners, if you can imagine something like that almost every day when Robert is breaking set down something, talking about it, putting real science to work and putting the numbers with it. You know, one that really kind of caught my eye the other day was actually one that was entitled "The Dark Money Behind the Gas Bans." And this was kind of talking about gas stoves. And I can't believe here we are getting ready for summertime and we're still talking about banning gas stoves. Can you?
Sure. Well, so about that piece, and by the way, so I'm glad you're talking about Power Hungry. That book's 13 years old. My new book is A Question of Power, Electricity, and the Wealth of Nations, and the paperback on this one's going to be out in May. But so
what? Six books, oh, my gosh. I cannot wait.
Well, thank you. This book has been out now since, it's been out 3 years.
So that's right.
Paperback will be out. So buy them all. You don't have to read them. You just have to buy them. So we didn't have to work that line in, right? So the piece, yes, the dark money behind the gas bans. You know, one of the reasons that I wrote that piece was that we have heard over and over again from climate activists, from NGOs, from alt-energy promoters that, there's a lot of dark money on the right, and that the oil and gas industry in particular is funding a lot of, you know, dark money groups that are, you know, preventing action on climate change. This is one of the claims that has been made over and over and over again. By Bill McKibben, by, you know, the Sierra Club, by other groups that are claiming, oh, we're not getting climate action because of dark money groups. The reality is that dark money groups on the left, from climate activist groups, they are some of the ones that are the funding these efforts to ban natural gas stoves and the direct use of natural gas in homes and businesses all across the country. So one of the groups I focused on in my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com, is this group Rewiring America.
Yeah.
They are a sponsored project of the Windward Fund, which has annual revenues of over $200 million. They don't reveal the identities of any of their funders. One of the other big groups that's behind these efforts to ban the direct use of natural gas, which is the cheapest form of in-home energy,
yes,
according to the Department of Energy's own data, is Climate Imperative. Who are the funders of Climate Imperative? Well, one of them appears to be Lorraine Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow. That group, Climate Imperative, is the biggest and richest NGO that you've never heard of. Their annual budget is over $200 million a year. The amount of money, just in the dark money world, and that is that where area, you know, these the nonprofits, these NGOs that are funding these efforts, their budgets are measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The, you know, the American Petroleum Institute, the other industry oriented, or the groups that are backing the hydrocarbon sector, they are getting outspent by a country mile. I mean, it is not even close.
Yes, no, in the article you show here, and just these four groups alone are already spending money at a rate of, basically these four groups spend the rate of 25 pro hydrocarbon groups, basically.
That's right.
And so you're absolutely right that they're spending all this money. And then they brought in, I think, Ms. Stacey Abrams to help out in a way that I don't want to, I'm going to dance around it, but I find it interesting that they bring her in to help the communities, is the way they use it, to get them all on board for natural gas. I mean, excuse me, for electricity rather than natural gas. But, you know.
And if you don't mind, I'll follow up on that, Ray, because Stacey Abrams, is, you know, she's a politician, right? She was in the Georgia House of Representatives, high profile politician. She ran for governor of Georgia twice, lost twice. In the first election, I guess in 2018, she refused to concede. Well, she just took a job with Rewiring America, which is a group that I was just mentioning, funded by the Windward Fund, a dark money group. And she claimed in the press release that, you know, announced her hiring, that she's going to help, you know, her communities and low-income communities electrify everything. Well, electricity is far more expensive in terms of, in a per BTU basis, than natural gas is.
Yes.
So, you know, she is joining this group. I don't know what they're paying her. Good for her. She's got a job.
No.
But does she really understand what's going on here? And I don't know if she does. Perhaps she does. If she does, credit to her. But what this electrify everything push is, in fact, a regressive tax on the poor and the middle class. There's no other way to put it. And yet there, it's being couched in these terms of, this is essential for climate change. You know, we have to ban these natural gas stoves. You know, residential use in the United States, Ray, has not changed. It's been 5 trillion cubic feet a year since I was in grade school. Hasn't changed at all in more than 50 years.
That's
and
right.
yet, this is the big demon now that we have to get rid of.
Well, why is it such a big demon? And because, you know what, when you go back and look at this Rewiring America, it's funded not only by these groups, but these groups all have people that have heavy dollars invested in wind and solar. Wink, wink. I mean, it's like, it's almost like they're trying to capture the next big energy source. You know, I'm going to play a little bit here on the dumb side, that when oil became what it is, nobody knew that it was going to become the behemoth that it is. I'll say that when we, you know, when Spindletop was discovered, when we really learned all the power that we have behind it. And now I feel like the government and people are really trying to control the next big power source. And they're already controlling natural gas, which, like you've mentioned, is a very inexpensive product. And it also burns very clean. So why is it that you have all this basically secret banning of these natural gas stoves, or the anti-natural gas movement going on?
Sure. Well, so just to put some numbers to this. So in California now, there are over 70 communities that have banned or restricted the direct use of natural gas in homes and businesses.
Yeah.
So, and then the Bay Area Air Quality Management District just a few weeks ago announced that they will prohibit in that 9-county area the sale of gas-fired heaters and gas stoves beginning, I think, in 2027.
Okay.
So these are regulations that are in the offing or being passed now that will begin taking effect. So what are the consequences of this, Ray? Well, California's electric grid is already shaky, right? And so they've had blackouts now for, you know, ongoing for years. And so they're going to put yet more electric demand on a grid that is already faltering under existing demand. And we haven't yet talked about electric vehicles, which is the other part of the equation here that will add even more demand, as much as 50% an increase in electricity demand on the California power grid, according to Southern California Edison. So then, so that's a preface to your question. Well, why are these groups doing it? Well, I look at it just in pure political terms. If you look at it from a hard political outlook and you think, okay, well, what is going to be the easiest battle for these anti-hydrocarbon groups, for these climate activist groups? Well, it's to I think the political fight is easier banning natural gas stoves by going to cities like Berkeley, California, the first to ban natural gas, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, or other small liberal towns in liberal states where you can pass these local ordinances and then say, see, all these groups are doing it and we're going to get more momentum. And in fact, that's what they've done. So give them credit for their political strategy. It's working. But I think it's also pernicious because I think it is adding more power demand on a grid that is already, particularly in California, can't handle it. But also it's going to cost consumers more money. There's just no doubt about it.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up the fact that this is going to bring up this is going to cost consumers more money, because I wanted to highlight another one of your Substack articles titled Untransformed, where you dive into things like we were just talking about in California, where prices have already skyrocketed, but that how electric prices have already began to soar, and that this is actually due to the appropriations and subsidies possibly from the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, do you see that? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, this is another piece that I had been collecting string on for a long time. I do a lot of public speaking. That's really how I make my money. I don't have any sponsors for my podcast. I don't belong to any outfits. I'm a bad employee. I work for myself, and I have groups that hire me to come talk to them, explain what I see in the world. So I speak to a lot of electric cooperatives around the country. And last May, I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I heard a presentation by Matt Brandrup, who's with the Rural Electric Supply Cooperative. And he talked about price inflation. Well, I checked with him a few weeks ago, and he sent me his latest data. Last year, Ray, all across the electric sector in what are called utility products, so that's everything from wood poles and wire to transformers, pad-mounted transformers, and copper wire, right? Yeah. 18% inflation last year. 18%. The U.S. inflation rate overall was 8%, and electric prices last year went up 12.5%. So when you add the inflation from 2022 of 18% on top of the inflation that occurred in utility products in 21, which was 14%, you're talking about a 34% increase, so an increase in price of one-third for all these utility products that are going to be required under the demand, for the demand for which is soaring because of this electrify everything push, as well as all this new solar and wind that's being added to the grid. So this indicates that these grid upgrades that are going to be required for this electrify everything push, all the stuff that is needed to upgrade the network is soaring in price, which means you upgrade the network over time. That means consumers are going to pay higher prices, and it's axiomatic. So increased copper prices, of course, this is one of the things everybody's been talking about lately.
Yeah,
we don't have extra copper. The copper price has been rising. This is just one example. So, but this is all tied into shortages of labor, which are a common issue in the oil patch, of course. But all of this is connected. So I wrote that piece to underscore the fact that this is yet another example of unintended consequences by these people, by these influential interest groups, dark money groups that are saying, oh, we need to, force everyone. It's forced electrification, not beneficial electrification. Forcing consumers to use electricity and have less energy security and pay higher prices. It's bad policy.
Well, it's very bad policy, and especially when they're trying to say that, hey, going electric, this electric transition is going to cost you next to nothing. Well, that's not true, because like you just mentioned, the supply chain right now is ridiculous. You got to get the transformers. They've gone up in price. The wire, the copper, why? Because you can't get the copper, like you're saying. I'm glad you brought up Matt Barterup, that's who you were talking to in Michigan, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And I had him on my podcast, on the Power Hungry podcast just recently,
Matt
Brandrup.
Yes.
But then I also interviewed another co-op guy, Buddy Haston from the Arkansas Electric Cooperative Corporation. They own a company called ERMCO, which is one of the biggest electric transformer producers in America. And he pointed out that ERMCO, they could hire 600 or 700 more people now if they could find them to produce more transformers, but they can't find them. So, this is something I've heard over and over as I travel around the country talking to people, particularly manufacturers. All of them are short labor. And this is a situation that, we've seen because of baby boomers retiring, post-COVID issues. But, this is a problem that's going to persist all across the economy, and is going to add yet more inflation across the entire economy, because employers are going to have to pay higher wages to keep people.
Yeah. No, it's almost like it was the perfect storm with COVID. Baby boomers are now retiring. And then when I use the words, hey, man, it's a supply chain issue. We mean it from the start to the end. There are issues everywhere, from making it to getting it delivered to getting it installed. We don't have the people that can make the product. We don't have the people that can deliver the product. We don't even have the material to make the product. And the weird, the other crazy part is that the demand is still outpacing the supply. You know, due to these subsidies and other deals, like people, we still are trying to get this grid to a place. And we got to remember, it took us over 100 years to build the infrastructure that we have today. We can't just change it in a year or two, can we? Excuse me.
No, it's impossible, and that's a key point. Remember, Edison began centralized electricity centralized power plants 140 years ago in Lower Manhattan. So we built the grid over decades. We're not just going to simply change everything and do it in a couple of years or even a couple of decades. One of the points that I made in that piece, Untransformed, on my Substack, robertbrice.substack.com, you can subscribe. It's free. I mean, even something as common as wood poles, they're up between 2021, that went up 25%. In 2022, they went up 46%. So you're talking about a 70% increase in just 2 years for something that you don't even think about, that you see commonly around town or at your city or local, you know, neighborhood. A wood pole is up 70% in price. And, you know, one of the other things that I didn't talk about in that piece on Transformed, Ray, was that we're looking at this is now an international market. And I focus in that piece on domestic transformers, pad mounted and pole mounted transformers, both of which are up dramatically over the past year, 2 years. Yeah. But the large, what are called power transformers that you see in substations, effectively all of those are made overseas. We are not producing those here in the United States. So we are not, I think, not thinking about this supply chain in terms of very basic energy security. We're relying on foreign providers, foreign manufacturers, for supplies of critical infrastructure at our substations. Well, why isn't this being discussed? We're, you know, instead, it's here's the government, you know, particularly the Biden administration, cheering on this electrify everything push with no understanding of what it means to in the physical network. And that's the key, is that it's easy to talk about policy, and that's one of the things these NGOs have an advantage. They're only pushing policy. They don't have to deliver molecules and electrons. The energy and power companies do. Yeah. And so it's not a symmetric fight. In fact, it's a very much an asymmetric war, and I think it is a war. And I'll be clear with you, I think the oil and gas sector, the coal sector, the electric utilities, they're getting their butts kicked. I mean, it's not even close. I mean, they're just getting killed by these influential groups that have more money. They have the sympathy of the media, and they have a lot of momentum on their side. Give them credit. They're doing a good job.
They're definitely using the tools that they have. And, you know, for all of my listeners and everybody watching this episode of The Crude Truth, I recommend definitely going and subscribing to Robert's Substack and looking at this article Untransformed, because he really lays out the cost increase for specific utility products in the electric, you know, building a grid. And I mean, you figure it's an average of probably 30% on every product if you average them all out. And in the oil and gas industry, I was actually talking to my producer Andrew Wime before. He goes, "Well, what's going on?" I said, "Man, I'm trying to drill some wells, and you know, it's like costs have gone up so much right now that since we're not at, unfortunately, you know, steady at $75, $85 oil, we are finally getting back to there. But it's like, you know, it's harder for us to drill right now because all these costs have gone up. But as oil went down, none of those costs went down. Right. So we're in that, you know, same predicament on our side of things. But really, you know, I got this from you, that basically the gist of these pieces, you know, that I wanted to share is that the electrifying everything is really a path to fail. And, you know, we as the consumers are going to be the ones to pay the price if we really take this path of doing our best to electrify everything. Right, Robert?
Well, you know, the rules of plumbing also apply to electric grids, which is poop flows downhill, right? the consumer is the one that is going to pay. That is always the case. And we saw that after Winter Storm Uri, that yeah. when the gas utilities, the electric utilities, weren't fully prepared, and the grid didn't function well, and in fact, in some places, just outright failed. Now we've had, you know, utilities are securitizing a lot of their debt. Mm-hmm. Those are debts that are going to have to be paid by consumers. Mm-hmm. So all across the board, consumers are the ones that are going to have to pay for the cost of any of these efforts at the energy transition, et cetera. But we have to be clear-eyed about this. And that's what, if I, you know, what is my goal here? Yeah. What is my purpose in my work? It's to shine light on what is really happening in the physical world, and right. what are the numbers, and what is happening in reality, not in the spin. And so I consider myself very fortunate, Ray. I'm a very lucky guy. I live in Austin, Texas. I'm married to a wonderful woman. She, you know, got three great kids, and I'm able to work on issues that I think are important, and I get paid for it, and I get to talk to people like you. So, but I think that it's imperative that people who are in the industry know what the, you know, one, know your numbers. You have to know your data. You have yeah. to know the scale of the business. You have to be able to talk about it in a clear and a concise way. And yeah. you have to be able to help people that you know who may not be as informed as you are understand why it matters. And yes, so that's my hope. And I know that's part of why you do what you do. But I think it's certainly my motivation in my career and, you know, the I'm an old man now. I'm going to be 63 this year, but that's my plan to keep going. I don't have anything else to do, nothing else that I want to do.
Well, you know, I say continue the good fight, and I know all our listeners and all your followers and people that listen to you would definitely say the same thing, for you to continue this great fight that you're doing, because right now, good, bad, or any different, it's an uphill battle due to all the things you talked about, that right now, you know, the media and the money are backing another way. And so I can't thank you enough for what you're doing. I'm excited for the paperback version of your book to be coming out here this May. You know, we're running out on time here for people out there that want to get you in to one of their great symposiums and get you to come speak, or again, you know, for people to find your Substack. How can people contact you, Robert?
Oh, I'm easy to find, Ray. I'm on TikTok. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on the Google. You can find me pretty easily, but robertbrice.com is my website. And then I'm on Twitter at Power Hungry, PWR Hungry. TikTok, this is the same. So I'm the king of all media. I'm not hard to find. But I love this. I love these issues. I'm preparing for a presentation in Louisville in a couple of weeks to the Battery Council International, talking about what's happening in batteries, talking about the energy transition, speak to nuclear groups, cooperatives, electricity, oil and gas, all kinds of associations. I consider myself very lucky. But I think that the my book, by the way, the latest one you mentioned, Power Hungry, the latest book is A Question of Power. You don't have to read it. You just have to buy it and subscribe to my Substack. Yes, robertbrice.substack.com. But been great fun, Ray.
No, I can't thank you enough. And again, please check out, for anybody out there that hasn't checked out, Power Hungry Podcast. Robert has some of the best guests on there, just like I do. Robert, I cannot thank you enough, sir, for coming on to The Crude Truth. And I want to leave everybody again with The Crude Truth statement of this episode. Energy is the ability to do work. Power is a rate at which work gets done. And that's The Crude Truth. Be sure to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time on The Crude Truth.
This episode of The Crude Truth is brought to you by Oil and Gas Workers Association, Sandstone Group, Air Compressor Solutions, Basin Fluids, and The Fuel Pros.